Sorry, Selena, it is a junior.
Thank you. No, I was laughing. Mine's not as inventive as that, so it's usually first. I was invited to write with Brian Peake, which was an amazing invitation. I had never had a conversation with Brian, ever. I had read his work. Obviously, it would be impossible in this field not to have read his work. So I was one of those strange people who happens to be an early career researcher, while at the same time also being, as Prue Wells described me, not me intentionally, but as a senior, age-wise. So talking to this man who's been in the field for years and years and years, very well published, and yet our fields are also very different. Brian is very much in drama education, particularly in process drama, and I was a drama teacher. I worked in schools for many years, but my practice has moved into very different territories. So it was a delightful and slightly terrifying invite, complicated by the fact that over the writing period, Brian was predominantly in Jamaica and I was spending time in six different countries on various different projects. And rather irritatingly, discovered the day that I initiated our conversation that Pamela, who Brian usually writes with, lives 5 miles from my house. And Brian had just been there for 6 weeks. And had literally just got home. So we decided the only way that we could do this was via an email conversation. So we had a prolonged email conversation over 6 months with no verbal contact in that time at all. But that's not quite true. We had one brief Skype at the beginning and we decided that we weren't going to have any more conversations other than the email. And sometimes I would send a thing to Brian and I'd get something back in 5 minutes, and I'd be, oh my goodness, I've got to reply immediately. And other times, one or other of us, often both, would leave it for a month or two, and then we'd suddenly get an email out of the blue and go, oh, right, that's what we're doing. It was a joy, but I decided, poor Brian didn't have a choice, I decided that I was going to use the fact that he's such an experienced researcher to ask for his wisdom on a troubling position that I found myself in. We were specifically asked to reflect on our work as white, privileged university workers working in post-colonial environments. I suspect you thought Brian was going to write about Jamaica and I was going to write about India, but no, we wrote about Costa Rica and Zambia. Great. So what I'm going to read you is a part of the beginning of our chapter, which is me outlining my problem, which I sort of. It still makes me a bit breezy, actually, so I read it to the preamble bit, but on reading your chapter, I was reminded of working with students on a teaching and research project in the Talamanca region of Costa Rica in the June of 2006 and 2007. I remember sitting on the floor in the rainforest clearing. It was late afternoon. The indigenous community where we were living in just finished their work for the day and were returning to their homes. Their homes had no electricity or running water, and as such, their day ended when it got dark and started when their cock calls greeted the sun each day. This was a way of life that the elders of the community were trying to sustain in the face of fierce opposition, and I was part of their strategy. I and 4 students were listening to the village school teacher, Lionel, tell us the Bribri creation myth. It could have been a magical moment. The sun was setting. We each had a tiny piece of chocolate harvested by the community to suck on as the heat of the day subsided. The story was one of a vampire bat who fertilised the earth with the blood of a jaguar and of a tapir goddess who refused to bend to the will of her brother and marry a man she did not love. Her punishment was to be part of her spirit sent down to the earth. It could have been a magical moment, but it was so humid that even our eyelids were sweating. The chocolate was so bitter that it sucked out every tiny drop of moisture from our mouths. And Maimor was not reciting the myth from memory, He was reading it from a calendar produced for tourists by a European that had a traditional Costa Rican myth and drawing for each month of the year. The Bribri had initiated a cultural exchange with the university I worked for, and the aims of this exchange were in part to find a way for the tribal community to negotiate their place in an ever-changing world. They had developed a radical idea that they believed would allow them to maintain their way of life while using global tourism to fund that traditional lifestyle. Through a convoluted means, a connection was made by the Talamanca Association of Environment and Culture to an expat journalist and humanitarian aid worker to the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama. This resulted in four students being asked to spend 5 weeks living with the community to improve children's English, to take part in a cultural exchange, and most problematically, to offer a means of documenting and disseminating the Bribri Croatian myth using drama as a tool. I was deeply troubled by the idea that as British applied theatre researchers and practitioners, we were to document and disseminate an Indigenous people's myth in a project that involved dramatising a performance for this myth to be local, to be performed to local communities and tourists. The community were on one hand adjusting their identities to keep pace with the fluctuations of a rapidly changing world by learning new ways to perform their cultural myths for a tourist market as an attempt, on the other, to finance a lifestyle that was in complete conflict with the globalisation that they were using and using us to tap into a profit from. I'm going to skip a bit and read my last little bit of that section, which is, suddenly all of the concerns that we had at the start of this project about changing or mistranslating the story were amplified. We were already working from a changed, mistranslated and clearly Western version of the story. If we used this version of the story, we were surely adding to the colonialisation of their traditions and taking ownership away from the Bribri. We weren't working with an oral culture or an archive community with democratic participation, and we were definitely in an ethical minefield.
We're in a section of the book here called Provocations of Representation, and that is the chapter that kicks off that section by Selena and Brian. And next in that section is a chapter by Robin Pascoe and Peter Wright.
I'm going to stand up and you'll see why in a minute, because of course I'm not pictures, so just give me a moment while we make sure that things come up. Alright, I'll stop pushing the button then. Okay. So what were we thinking? You know, what was the application, if you like? And I'll be honest, because this came from a conversation that I've had with Peter Duffy as he was driving me to an airport in North Carolina, because we'd been there together, and we were talking about, you know, what would be a provocation. Oh, come on.
That's provoking.
That's
not what she means.
Okay. Pictures never work, do they? And it is to do with the issues of representation, of how do we represent our particular research as we are looking at it. Because the ways that research are often represented to us are reductive, or they're pseudo-scientific, or, worst of all, they just miss the richness of the experience themselves. The experience of being in the room itself. No? Who knows? All right, so the issues are, we have different ways of capturing and expressing the research. And the issue, of course, is how can we best do that, and what would be a better way of doing it? And we There you go. Thank you. Well done.
This is your question. Yes.
And, you know, we all know that the issues are that when you take an experience and you put it through the filter, that there are various ways that we can actually filter and reduce and make the experience or find ways of representing it. And each time we take it through enough filter, whether we take it through the filter of words or a metaphor or whatever, that in order to get to what's an acceptable, conventional, published form of research, you know, whether it becomes a video or whatever, there are choices that are made. So that's the sort of idea that we had in mind, that we were thinking about that. And our provocation was that we knew that research had to be accessible, that it had to have verisimilitude, and that it had to be an evocation for the reader. And we were thinking about how images are transactional objects as catalysts and so on for making things happen. So we connect, exchange, inspire people. And therefore, we went, oh, why don't we try a graphic novel?
Nice.
So, you know, visual images are stylized, they're simplified, they have different ways of implying movement, they include written words, they give us stories, there are lots of different ways of being able to read them. You don't have to read in a strictly linear way, okay? They can appeal to a new generation, different generation, if you like. They can manipulate points of view, perspective, focus, light, shade, tone, colour, all of that stuff. So that's kind of where we got to when we were thinking about this. And what I'm going to read is just a little bit from the conclusion. So we argue that the graphic novel format provides visibility, knowability, responsibility. The format offers a wider field of potential readers, increased visibility for drama researchers. Secondly, it offers different pathways to knowing the field of research explored through adding dimensionality to the immersive, engaging with other ways of knowing, imaging, and imagining the future. Finally, it offers enhanced ways of responding to drama research, thereby adding value to how audiences for research interact and respond and are potentially called to action. Put differently, underlying our approach is kind of planned materialism, working with different materials, working with materials differently to make research accessible. And if the truth be known, this article rose from a tongue-in-cheek comment that, you know, I made to Peter in that car journey. Perhaps we could present research as a graphic novel. But what started as a jest evolved into a more sustained exploration of the challenges of representation and sharing authenticity of experience. There is a fundamental issue for researchers in all fields, but particularly resonant for the arts and arts education. The standard conventional research report, as I've said before, is reductive. It relies on neutering of words, occasional table and images, and it's hostage to a scientific worldview that delimits it. The intrinsic qualities of an art form or arts learning are at best muted, even when richly described. So we argue that the graphic novel approach can both stand on its own and can stand alongside explanation and exegesis, because the role of the researcher is to capture, analyse and share information in an accessible form. The researcher is representing the phenomenon of interest. And that is what is observed, shared, thing, the person, the action, in written, visual, multimodal, and performative ways. and the act of representation could even be thought as a form of transubstantiation, transforming something and presenting it in place of the original. The graphic novel format is another potential tool in this mercurial and enigmatic process. Thank you.
Now you can turn it off. Oh, yes, thanks, Robin. The next two chapters are... For the next two chapters, I'll hand over, please.
Okay. So after this particular chapter, we have a chapter by Emma Selwyn and Lisa Tibet, who wrote a chapter about an amazing project. The chapter's called Giant Bodies, Punk, Rock, Queer, Cabaret, Cripping and Queering, Emancipating Disability Research. It's fantastic. But we're not going to cover that because they're not here. So in the last part of the book, so we're out of part four, and this section is provocations of practice, where we're actually talking about the how of what we do it and what we do in the research space. So the first of these chapters is the chapter that our my colleagues here, our workshop was based on this morning, called We Need to Talk About Theory, Rethinking the Theory Practice Dichotomy. Rigor in drama research.
So rather than explain what we did at the beginning of the chapter, it explains what we did and what we hope to do. So we need to talk about theory, rethinking the theory practice dichotomy in pursuit of rigor in drama research. Introduction. In this chapter, the authors engage with some of the theoretical assumptions sitting at the heart of drama. They explore what can be made possible by a turn to post-structuralist theory as a tool through which to research pedagogically rich encounters. Structured as a critical and confessional dialogue between practitioner researchers, this chapter demonstrates how an engagement through theory can provide a rich set of metaphors through which to account for the types of learning that can occur through drama-based practices.
The methodology, our approach to writing this chapter took a while to emerge. At the start of the project, all we knew was that we wished to engage with and question the deep and sometimes hidden assumptions at the heart of drama practice. We began with a three-way spoken exchange about what we thought those assumptions were. Though rich and fruitful, this spoken dialogue, transacted through various online platforms, was experiential and didn't readily lend itself to translation in a written form. However, we wanted to preserve the dialogic nature of our exchange, which permitted for a difference in view rather than the compression into one voice typically presented in a co-author paper. Hence, we elected to proceed through an epistolary form. Each of us took turns to produce a confessional letter, describing an aspect of our practice, either something habitual or something really cherished or something readily dismissed. These were the practices that we thought might be illuminated through interrogation from distance and theoretical perspectives. The commitment to reciprocate, the delay between the confessional offer and the written response, and the curiosity to read each other's disembodied responses were important generative factors. They assisted us to lean into the text and provided a genre for thinking through theory. This chapter contains an edited selection of confessions and responses resequenced to permit representation here in linear form. In reality, there was an overlap in offer and response, and the thought lines were seamed through each other rather than separate episodic evolutions. The chapter represents a crafted moment in which we understand to be an ongoing process of conversations before enough and conversations with others yet to respond. The following epistolary exchange we draw from variously on these metaphors of a machine, like a sandwich, Rizzo, Nomad, using them as thought frames through which to interrogate practice. And we're going to focus on the first of these confessional letters and our responses to that, just as one example.
Yeah, we've only got time for one confession, so we picked me. Confession from Viv, Rituals and Blind Spots. Dear Chris and Helen, I've decided to write to you about a habit of practice that I have developed and use almost religiously in my own practice, as well as recommending it to students and teachers who are learning to use drama in the classroom. It concerns teaching in role, or more particularly practices I adopt to ensure that the tradition into role is clearly and explicitly signalled. For the last few years, I've introduced students to teaching role by modelling a simple process drama adapted from a New Zealand Ministry of Education resource. Thank you, Elizabeth and others for this. The drama is based on a picture book, a Kiwi classic, about a lighthouse keeper and his wife. The story is delightful, if a little Eurocentric and heteronormative. In the drama, the teacher takes on the role of Mrs. G, Mrs. Grinling, the lighthouse keeper's wife. In my version of the drama, which is different from the published version, the transition into role occurs at the very start of the lesson, before the children know anything about the story, the situation, or the characters. And it's at this point that my habit of practice comes into play. I find myself insisting on the importance of being very explicit about the clear signalling of the role. Indeed, I generally teach beginning teachers that there is a three-step process to follow. Step one, tell them what is going to happen. In a moment, I'm going to take on the role of Mrs. G, the lighthouse keeper's wife. Step two, tell them how they will know. You'll know I'm in role when I put on this apron. They're laughing at me. Step three, secure their agreement. For this to work, you need to accept me in this role and work with me as if I'm really Mrs. G, okay? What happens next in the Lighthouse Keeper drama is that the teacher puts on an apron and speaks as Mrs. G. You haven't seen my husband, have you? Or my cat, Hamish? They rode out to the lighthouse hours ago and I haven't seen the light come on. About 5 years ago, a young woman in my class abruptly brought my attention to the heteronormative qualities of this picture book I was using to introduce to the teacher enrolled to the class. This woman just could not see herself in the text, and she was prepared to speak truth to power and interrupt the class to let me know. The conversation we had prompted me to deal with the text much more critically and to encourage students to do so. These days, I still use the same picture book and the same wonderful lesson structures to introduce teacher and role, but now I explicitly invite students, to problematize the choice of story and to consider other books to work with in which their students might see other values and perspectives represented. I'm really pleased that I made this shift in my practice, but I regret that it was necessary for a student to have to point out my blind spot and educate me. I'm really grateful to have been confronted by someone who is brave, self-aware, informed, and articulate enough to speak up rather than sit through the experience politely. And it makes me reflect on how many times this must have happened before and since with students who, for whatever reason, are not in a position to speak out. And it makes me think about how theory helped her and me to shift things.
Ellen, to view. The metaphor of the web or the assemblage could be useful in understanding the work that these students may have been engaged in here. If we look through this metaphor, as modelled by Deleuze, we can imagine that the learners detected the sticky and web-like nature of gender norms by encountering their interconnected and adhesive nature in the story. Indeed, maybe it was because you used teacher in role as a way to hold the participants close to the workings of the story that they could begin to recognise the taken for granted within the narrative. In this case, the taken for granted included the dominant gender norms associated with the characters and their positions and roles. In her theoretical work, Judith Butler argues that gender norms are so naturalised that they constantly slip from our attention. That which seems natural remains invisible, and that which is often performed acquires the status of ritual. Given this slip to invisibility, is it possible that it was the embodied play inside the story that helped the students to detect the adhesive nature of the gender norms? Was it this embodied and three-dimensional encounter within the story that helped them to see the way that complex and interwoven threads of gender shape the persons and practices and the very storyline under explanation? Was it your performance as teacher in role, assuming apron, to note Mrs. or Mother, that helped to make visible the gendered structure of the story? Did your embodiment of the characters help the students to see the way complex and interwoven threads of gender adhere to persons and practices and storylines and turn up in this story, as in so many others? Did the material objects in this performance, the apron, make visible, as Butler argues, that gender itself is a costume performance?
In terms of lasting effect, I wonder, did your students play themselves just a little differently as they went home that night? Did they catch themselves critically musing about the characters they were served on TV that night? Did they double think the way in which they themselves played into or resisted the gendered norms they were born into? Did they stretch their capacity to be a critically conscious teacher? Did their recognition of the gendered nature of the tale leave a lasting shadow of suspicion about the work that a favourite story might be doing as it was replicated and enjoyed by the children in their charge? Regards, Helen.
Christopher, dear Viv, thank you for this pearl of a story. It's interesting that you chose such a fundamental habit of practice for our discussion. A number of aspects of your story resonate with me, particularly your commitment to serve the children, the art form, and the teachers who are being taught to use Tetra in role. It's a three-way action of service you're describing here, as you aim to set in train the beginnings of practice for teachers so they can let the art form, learn to let the art form do its job in their classrooms. Strong signalling your role allows teachers to engage in the fiction with their students. So in this habit, you're working towards, I see, teacher empowerment by focusing on the need to signal their role in drama. You open up the space for the teachers to pedagogically play with the art form and lead the learning of their students through play. The cues and clues you want them to use provide the initial constellations on the map of the dramatic engagement in the learning process and provide students with a clear sense of the teacher's role in the invitation to play for the sake of learning. Signalling within the fiction enables both the teachers and the learners to be transported to new places, vistas and relations in and through role play. I'm only at the beginnings of my speed theory dating with Deleuze and Guattari, but I wonder if this moment of work could be conceptualised as a line of flight. I see it as a moment in the learning where both teachers and students step across a threshold into a whole range of dramatic possibilities as the fictional context is conjured and co-created within the lesson. The threshold is not only the line between the real context and the fictional one, but also between the traditional student-teacher relationship to one of co-players. Paradigms of teacher-student shift at this threshold moment as new creative lines of possibilities are opened up in this space. What happens next is a shared creative act that could take a number of different directions. I see it as a moment of escape for both teacher and students into a creative space and interaction, distinct from the prescriptive traditional classroom dyadic structure that our class education systems replicate. In this case, it would seem that clear signalling forms the firm ground underfoot, much needed to activate that creative line of flight. Regard, Chris.
I have a reply, but I'm worried about time.
Getting a bit twitchy. The performance is starting 5:15, so we've got 15 minutes. We started 15 minutes late, and we will be able to go to 5:15. Yeah. Oh, well, sorry, all the sessions are finished at 5:15, is what I should say, to allow us time to get there. Yeah.
I would like to perhaps just paraphrase my reply in a couple of sentences.
Sure.
So I found the restoring of the story so generous, and I reflect in my reply on the fact that on what theory brought to my thinking, that if I'd reflected on my practice only as a practitioner, it would be easy to reflect on the fact that, oh, wasn't it great that the student felt confident enough to speak up? I obviously empower students to a point where they feel they can speak safely in my class. And I might be tempted to use metaphors of emancipation and transformation and talk about the classroom as a space where I, as facilitator, learned and grew. However, I also enjoy reflecting on this event, this little moment of confrontation through the lens of theory, and how her own knowledge of queer theory gave the student the language to speak up, describe and question what she was experiencing. And with her help, I went to do some more reading and encountering terms like otherizing, hegemony and hybridity, with which I could recognize, illuminate, confront and then shift my teaching practice later. So my my interaction with the student and with theory in this space has led me to think that theory teaches us that we're not the first to stumble into territory and we're not alone. There's a body of work that's come before, providing ways to clarify, complexify, illuminate and open new conversations that can affect not only our research but also our teaching.
We'll move straight upon to a chapter written by John O'Toole and Peter Duffy, and I'll hand it over to John to take us through that. Thanks, John.
How are we going to stand?
We're re-embodying a disembodied conversation. Appropriately, the book ends with a chapter on impact. And as it's a book about drama, we've written it as a three-act play. And as it's about contemporary trends, it's set in cyberspace. Taking a leap from a presentation that Peter O'Connor and I did for Ideary back in 2003 on his own PhD research, it takes the form of an electronic conversations between two contrasting PhD students, fictional this time, with their two supervisors, and the challenges and problems they face to create impact from each of the 3 years of their study. The scene, Institute for Maximizing Performance of Applied Knowledge in Theatre. Impact. Dramatis personae, Dean of the Institute, Professor Angela Distant, Biff O'Hare, PhD student and theatre education officer. Terry Tortuga, PhD student and early childhood teacher. Associate Professor Hope Wannabe. Terry and Biff are her first PhD students. And Professor Harvey Mugwan, mentor to Dr. Wannabe and associate supervisor of both of them. Act one, year one.
From Dean Impact, Ms. Tortuga and Mr. O'Hare, as you embark on your higher degrees, I want to welcome both of you to Impact as our newest scholars, and hope you enjoy a fruitful stay in our Institute. I'm writing to you jointly because here at the Institute we provide ourselves on being a community of scholars, engaged in collaborative research, and that we can make a greater impact together. You'll be expected to take part in Institute colloquia involving staff and students. Our excellent website and your supervisors will give you all the information you need. I wish you the best of luck over the next 3 years. For the Dean, Professor Angela Distant.
At Big Biff, got first email as doc student from the Dean. It proves to neocons the power of theatre ed from Dr. O'Hare. At, take that.
At Terry the Tortoise. Got first email as a doc student from the Dean. Hashtag oh shit. Hashtag what did I just do? Hashtag in over my head.
From Pip O'Hare to Professor Mugwell. Hi, Prof. I had an awesome intro at the introduction last week, Prof. And I really appreciated my first supervision with Hope yesterday. I hope we're going to get on great. Please don't mind me pestering you. A query about the research question. Mine is going to be affirming the benefits of theatre and education for the social and academic enhancement of young people through curriculum-based theatre and education. I want my research to make an impact. Hope confused me, though, by saying that research and advocacy aren't the same thing, but opposites. I don't get it. Can you explain? Warmest, Viv.
Professor Mugwump to Biff O'Hare. Hi, Biff. You caught me at a good time this morning. About your research question, Hope is quite right about research and advocacy. We've all got a bit used to making grand claims to get funding and convince the sceptics. But you can't set up your question to prove what you want. Certainly plan provisionally for how you're going to make an impact if your research turns out the way you hope, but also plan for what use you can make of it if in fact it doesn't even, or even indicates the opposite. Just think how useful that'll be in making an impact on all those overblown claims of future researchers. And you really think that analysing a couple of TIE programmes will conclusively show that social and academic enhancement of young people, all young people, just forget affirming and welcome what you find. And by the way, your question is not a real question, because by assuming benefits, you're preempting the answer. And in fact, it's not a question at all. Good discipline to phrase it with a question mark at the end.
Oh, yeah, from Biff O'Hare to Professor Wannabe, dear Hope. Now I get it. Professor's email was a bit of a road to Damascus moment for me that it's taken me 3 days to get my head around. The original research question really sucked, didn't it? Here's my new RQ. This one does have a question mark. It's draft only. Feedback, please. Can any changes be identified in attitudes to history studies in two contrasting school classroom settings as a result of a curriculum-based TIE program? Best, Biff.
Group text, Biff O'Hare, Prof and Prof Motherland, from Hope One of Them. Road to Damascus indeed, Biff. You're on the right track. This new question is vastly improved, but you're right, it still needs some work. What are the variables you want to know more about? What phenomena do you already know about them? What are the conventions we need to know more about? Drill down deeper. Think about the how and what questions. I'm excited to see what you come up with. Let's make a time to meet when I return from my conference next week. I'm back on Thursday in haste from China from my iPhone.
From Terry Kotuka to Professor Wannabe. Dear Professor Wannabe, can you explain to me, please, what is meant in the higher degree rules by new knowledge? Will it be enough if I just complete a literature review of early childhood play and show that it's new knowledge for me? If I have to do some field work, can I just do a case study of a student in my class? Yours respectfully, Terry.
From Prof Wannabe to Terry Tortuga. Hi, Terry. Good to hear from you. You're settling into the program well. Sorry to be a bearer of bad news, but it would not count to have knowledge to be new to you. That's a good question, an important one to understand, particularly at the start of your PhD journey. The process of getting your PhD is an opportunity to learn how a researcher goes about creating new knowledge. You don't have to be perfect at it, it's a process. Both Harvey and I and every other faculty member have been through that process many times before. Now remember, new knowledge doesn't have to need to solve the drama equivalent of the human genome with each research project you undertake. You simply have to ask a question that hasn't been asked in that way before and figure out reasonable methodologies to discover possible answers to your question. Conducting a thorough lit review is not the be-all and end-all, but you're right that it is essential. This is how you learn where the gaps in the field and in your research can help fill them. As the saying goes, an arrow in the library says from a year in the lab. Make sure you connect contact Professor Mugwump about case studies. He's a leading expert and will be able to give you the best advice. We'll talk again next week when I'm back from London. Hope from my iPhone.
From Professor Mugwump to Terry Tortuga. Your plan for a case study that centres on gender influences and how dramatic play is organised among children could be an important contribution, depending on the question you ask and the scale at which you ask it. But you'll follow one child, you say? It's risky. Just suppose what happens if that child moves or gets sick during your study? Where will you be? And if the child turns out to be outside conventional scales? The study will be interesting only as a freak study, not relevant to anyone else, and so make no impact. And you do want to make an impact, even if you don't think you do. And also, dramatic play at school age is most interesting at the social level, or it's a very, very limited study. Like nearly any play, you need more than one actor to make dramatic action. So I suggest you think a bit broader for your research question. There are a lot of great resources to help navigate this challenging but rewarding line of inquiry. I'll include a few of them at the end of this conversation. Communication. Keep it up. Harvey.
In second year, Act 2, Biff and Terry are confronted by new challenges for impact when impact, the institute that is, demands milestones in the shape of producing a refereed journal article and making at least one conference presentation. In Act 3, we see them collecting their PhDs and going out into the world to make an impact with them. There are some surprises for both along the way, and we hope for the reader.
we've almost come to the end of our session, but Chris just wants to tell you about one last chapter, and then...
We're not going to read it, there's not time for it. There was one just before that chapter, which was a chapter written by Peter and I, and we used geo-ethnography as our metric of exchange, and looked at ourselves as being learners, and then as researchers, and looking at what our stories of learning told us about our stories.
And at the risk of saying like a plug, of which it is, the book published by Brill is out in November. And we thank you all very much for your attendance
today. Thank you.